This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you are listening to our live broadcast in the morning, we are less than an hour away from a highly anticipated Senate Intelligence Committee hearing. Former FBI Director James Comey will appear before that committee as a private citizen to answer questions about whether he believes President Trump tried to obstruct an ongoing federal investigation into the president's associates. This stems from an FBI investigation into Russian involvement in the November election, as well as possible ties to Russia among members of the Trump campaign. The Washington Post has characterized this morning's hearing as potentially historic because a former senior official may repudiate a president who has lashed out at the government he leads. Further, the Post quotes Tracy Schmaller, a former Senate Judiciary Committee staffer, as saying, Comey has made a career of providing bombshell testimony to Congress. Even without that comment, anticipation of what Comey might say has been high. The president has characterized all of this, including the investigation by special counsel and former FBI Director Robert Mueller, as a politically motivated witch hunt. And though it cannot be denied that politics is certainly fueling some of this, there are serious questions to be answered. So in advance of today's hearing, a conversation about politics, mainly surrounding this investigation, but also, if we get time to it, the drawing of voting districts in North Carolina, which have recently been struck down for a third time by the U.S. Supreme Court. Dr. Adolphus Belk is a professor of political science at Winthrop University. He joins us in our Spirit Square studio along with Dr. Susan Roberts, who serves in a similar capacity at Davidson College. Welcome back to you both. Nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Good morning. Also with us by phone is Dr. Carl Campbell, Associate Professor of History at Appalachian State University. He joins us from Durham. Welcome to you.
I'm glad to be here.
There are those on the political right who agree with the president and consider these investigations needless witch hunts. Some of those same people feel that the media is making far too much of these investigations, and particularly the hearing that's coming up in the next hour. Some have characterized coverage as being breathless, as being sensational. CNN yesterday called this Washington's Super Bowl. Is this hyperbole? Are those fair criticisms, Dr. Roberts?
Well, I think they were fair criticisms yesterday, but I think the release yesterday, last night, of the testimony really put a little bit of a dent in there because it was more muted. You didn't find out, quote-unquote, the things that people anticipated. I think you had to read between the lines once you got the testimony, but there were comparisons to Oliver North, Anita Hill, Hillary Clinton on Benghazi, and so forth. And I don't think at this point the testimony reveals that, but the key, I think we'd all agree, is in the Q&A. What's going to happen there?
Well, the testimony you're referring to is the statement that the committee released yesterday from James Comey, which is his opening remarks, much of which is old news. Is it simply, Dr. Belk, the groundwork, the entry point for what's to come next in the hearings?
Well, two quick points. First, I don't think it's hyperbolic. I mean, the Super Bowl is supposed to be a joyous occasion, right? People watch the Super Bowl. They're happy the Super Bowl is on. This is more in the order of a constitutional crisis that we haven't seen in decades. You basically had 17 U.S. intelligence gathering agencies come to the conclusion that Russians attempted to interfere in the American election and did so with the intent of harming Secretary Clinton while aiding then-candidate Mr. Trump. And that's something that has to be dealt with. So there is a legitimate need to investigate what's happening here. And then in terms of what former FBI Director Comey did last night, he reset the conversation. Mr. Trump has made every effort to deflect the conversation away from Comey's testimony, from announcing a new FBI director to giving a talk, to doing all these things to try to draw attention away from this event and to himself. And so by releasing that letter, the former FBI director is resetting the conversation, getting it back to where he wants it to be.
Mm-hmm. Why did they – is it normal, Dr. Campbell, for them to release the opening statement 24 hours before the opening statement is made live in front of the committee?
Maybe it's kind of redundant to say that nothing has been very normal or regular in the Trump administration over the last few months. But this particular thing happened before. When John Dean was ready to testify, they leaked his statements in advance And so the Irvin Committee in Watergate was able to know pretty much, and the public was able to be prepared for what was going to happen. So it isn't that unusual, actually, for such a statement to be leaked in advance.
Why? Why would they do it at all? Why don't they just leave it for today, and we'll all see what happens today? Why leak it out in advance? What's the point?
I think we need to understand that what's happening today is political theater. I don't think people should be thinking about this so much as legal debates or even political. This is theater. And we're trying to set narratives and plots and character development. So today is the day that people are going to sit back and try to understand what is this really all about? I mean, what is the storyline? So by Comey letting this information out in advance, it allows the senators and the public and the press to chew on the way that he sees this, and it appears that Comey is suggesting that this is some kind of a storyline about obstructing justice. But this could be a story that has many other plots as well, and so I think that's why.
Dr. Bell.
In battling allegations of collusion and obstruction of justice, President Trump has tried to undermine the reputation of James Comey, and he said in a May 10th meeting with Russians, a day after he fired the FBI director, quote, "He was crazy, a real nut job. I faced a great pressure because of Russia. That's taken off," unquote. So if you're Comey, you have to reestablish your legitimacy in the eyes of the American people and demonstrate that you have documentation of the interactions that you had with the president and point to the things that you think warrant further investigation.
This is a little off the topic, I suppose, because it's about the hearings and what's about to be said here this morning. But Dr. Roberts, the president has had a history of saying negative things about other departments in the government. The comments that Dr. Belk just quoted about James Comey to the Russians, which made the press, these are very negative, very not presidential in any way. What is this doing to our institutions, this kind of loose-lip conversation that it would be okay if Mr. Trump were still a private citizen businessman, but is out of character for the presidency?
Well, I think that most of us would agree he doesn't understand. Being president, he has contempt, as Nicholas Kristof said today, contempt for the rule of law. He treats these government officials, his administration, as employees. And I think even though we look at this and we look at the remarks, and perhaps we can anticipate how political the questions are going to be, the Democrats versus the Republicans, I think that you can look at it and see this is questioning the legitimacy. I think President Trump doesn't understand what it's like to be president. He doesn't understand what it is, the process. And I think that we can charitably say he has a blatant disregard or stubbornness to really get into the questions. I think this is it's not unpresidential. I think it also really reveals, and I think everyone would agree with this, his personality.
Yeah.
And we've come to expect these things from Donald Trump. Does that mean we're jaded? I think there's a point that we are jaded. We don't look at it and say, oh, yeah, that's extraordinary. And as Dr. Balkus pointed out, a constitutional crisis, we just say, oh, that's Donald Trump.
Has anybody ever done this in history, Dr. Campbell? Because there's an article, I think it's an editorial or an op-ed piece in the Charlotte Observer this morning, where somebody says this is not unlike Abraham Lincoln if he were to have opened the White House window every 20 minutes late at night and screamed things about, I'm going to defeat the South. But he, of course, didn't do that. Is there any historical precedent for a precedent for a president to speak like this?
Well, not really presidential. I mean, there's certainly been politicians, even here in North Carolina, that have had this kind of a populist attack on institutions. Perhaps some people will remember our Bob Reynolds, who was kind of our Huey Long here in North Carolina in the 1930s. And he certainly was able to use the technology of his day, the radio, and to distract and entertain. But Twitter provides the president an immediate connection. We all wish that someone would take that thing away from him, and indeed people are trying to do it. But maybe it's the technological difference. Maybe it's Donald Trump that's the difference. But yeah, in history, we have seen other presidents that have followed these strategies.
Because some people have taken what the president does on Twitter and ridiculed him for it. And he is his own worst enemy when it comes to legal actions on Twitter, because some of the things that he's saying on Twitter undermines his defense going forward. But is this more than Trump being Trump? Could this be a very smart move on his part to make political hay through the Twitterverse?
I mean, like Dr. Kent.
We're analyzing this for a minute. I mean, what are our possible interpretations? We can say that President Trump and his White House are bumbling incompetence. We can say that they are actually shrewdly abusing power. Or we could say that there is evidence that they have colluded with an enemy of the United States of America and are covering it up. I mean, these are very different interpretations of what's happening. If you're defending Trump, none of these defenses sound very good. I personally think that what we're about to see is a change to another attack from the Trump administration, which was alluded to earlier, I think, by Dr. Roberts. I think we're about to see more attacks on the institutions of American democracy. I think that given the other interpretations, we're going to hear that the press is unfair, the judges are unfair, Congress is unfair, and I think we're in for a very ugly summer.
Dr. Bilk.
The press has been a special foe as far as the Trump administration is concerned. He talks about the fake news, mainstream, the fake mainstream media. But while trust in the media is in decline, and there's certainly a partisan and ideological divide when it comes to trust in the media, people do tend to trust the media to play the watchdog role in holding elected officials accountable for what they say and what they do. And when it comes to Trump and the American people with respect to trust, they don't trust him on this. A recent poll suggested that 61% of respondents thought that he dismissed Comey to cover up what happened with Russia. And so you have an FBI director who is investigating him who was fired. You have a former acting attorney general who recommended that he not hire Flynn because Flynn had been compromised by the Russians, and he fired her. And so those things are pointing to what could be a crisis situation. Now, I think that when we talk about looking at this in the long view of history, a little bit of trolling from the people who run the Twitter account for the Nixon Library, they said Richard Nixon never fired the director of the FBI.
Yeah.
So we are in some ways venturing out into uncharted territory.
I have a minute left, Dr. Roberts.
Well, I think we look at what recently happened yesterday, appointing his FBI director, and even the media said, oh, this is a shiny object. He wants to take away our attention. If you've watched some of the debates and things, you've seen what the split screen does. If you're watching the debates and then at the bottom you're taking the thermometer of how people are reacting, you do have your – it is distracting. And I think that's something that Trump might like. I usually don't have my cell phone with me, but I've got it right here to see if there's a pre-testimony kind of tweet. Real quickly, if you'll
– 30 seconds.
Yeah. Listen to this. Lock her up. Drain the swamp. A good guy, need loyalty, lift the crowd, a nut job, wish him luck. And that sums up what is, you know, the way Trump has looked at all this.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more about this in advance of the hearings scheduled for about 40 minutes from now if you're listening to our live broadcast. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts. Neil deGrasse Tyson presents the Cosmic Perspective Lecture on how the Earth's existence in an empty universe affects culture and politics. June 12th at Belk Theater. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org. And NC Warn, working to slow climate change by curbing methane emissions from the fracked gas and power industries. Information on clean energy alternatives at ncwarn.org. On the local news roundup, Mecklenburg County Health Director Marcus Plesher resigns after months of turmoil. The Supreme Court deals another blow to the North Carolina legislature over the drawing of 28 legislative districts. Roy Cooper joins a growing list of governors pledging to continue support for the Paris Climate Accord. And County Commission declares this Ramadan month. Those stories and more with our roundtable of reporters tomorrow on this program at 9.
Back in March, James Comey revealed the FBI was investigating potential links between the Trump campaign and Russia.
This will also include an assessment of whether any crimes were committed.
It wasn't long before President Trump fired him. Now, all eyes will be back on Comey when he appears in the Senate. I'm Robert Siegel. Complete analysis this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Comey testimony we're anticipating later on today and the things that have led up to it with Dr. Adolphus Belk, professor of political science at Winthrop University, Dr. Susan Roberts in the same capacity at Davidson College, and Dr. Carl Campbell, associate professor of history at Appalachian State University. I want to pick up on something. I think it was Dr. Campbell who mentioned this a moment ago before we continue on about the testimony, and that is the attack that has been unleashed on a series of American institutions. It could have been Dr. Belk that said this, too. I don't know who said it. The press, the Congress, the courts. We depend on all three of those things in our system of government, along with the executive branch, to have these institutions function appropriately. If you are successful at tearing them down, what are you left with? Anarchy?
I think one of the major problems here is that, as both Drs. Campbell and Roberts pointed out, there's a philosophical approach here, right? We know that there are differences on politics and policy between the two parties across all of the major issues. What you have right here in this administration, though, are a group of people who don't believe in the federal government as it's operated over the last several administrations, Democrat or Republican. They've placed people in key administrative positions who do not share the mission of the agencies and institutions that they're charged with leading. So if we think about the Betsy DeVos nomination for Secretary of Education, this is a woman who has spent the entirety of her public political life advancing an agenda that's harmful to public education.
So are you saying that some of these comments coming out of the White House are not necessarily the rantings of a lunatic? They are a way to delegitimize things that we have come to think about as normal in life, and therefore we'll stop thinking about them and stop relying on them and become more, states' rights reliant or more self-reliant?
I think that it's intentional. And I also think that they cram so much into the public media discourse with the different things that they're doing that it makes it almost impossible to focus in a more direct and substantial way on the big issues that the nation is dealing with. And so if we look at what's happening right now with the Comey testimony, there's the FBI director, there's the talk, there's these series of tweets, there's all these things that are going on that are trying to suck the air out of the room, and it makes it difficult to focus on the things that I think we ought to focus on.
And historically speaking, I guess we've had a polarized press in the past, certainly in the early years of newspapers, and newspapers were much worse than our media today in terms of taking sides and calling names and characterizing people in horrible ways. But Dr. Campbell, is there any historical precedent for the public being so divided where they simply do not believe the other side, where the other side is putting out alternative facts, whatever they are?
I guess I want to answer that question in two ways. Historical precedent, certainly. I mean, in the 1880s and 1890s, people voted at unprecedented numbers, and the media, as you just said, the newspapers were very partisan, and there were two different views of seeing the world. Technology, of course, was very different, is much faster now. So I do think, but I think the other answer is that we need to think a little bit about how people perceive politics. And it isn't really a rational exercise. I mean, including all of us today here talking about this, we build a certain kind of constellation of values, and then we take the news into that view. And what happens in a political scandal, which is unlike most other political events, a scandal has a life of its own, and it begins to throw facts at our worldview that don't fit our worldview. So at first we can dismiss them, and then we can begin to dismiss the messengers, and then eventually at some point, over a long period of time, that cognitive dissonance has to be resolved. Now in Watergate, It took a year and a half to reach up to the water, the massacre on a Saturday night, for the opinions of people to begin to change. And so I kind of think that with this, we're at the very beginning of a process in which these facts will begin to come. And as was just stated there by Dr. Belk, it's difficult, given all of the noise, to focus. And I would suggest that that, too, is like previous political scandals. These stories don't come out clearly. They come out in bits and pieces, and they have to be put together over time. It's very messy right now, and I'm just fascinated to see if in a few days we'll start to get some clarity on what this story really is.
Dr. Roberts.
Well, I think we're very correct in saying it is not unprecedented, and I want to reiterate the role of social media, the 24/7 news cycle. I tell my students not to see this election through the lens and this administration of the Trump presidency. But if you look back, looking at Watergate, you can reduce it to a partisan botched burglary. You can look at Bill Clinton's problems as an affair, but this is a problem with national security, and this is a problem in terms of foreign governments and perhaps collusion. It's much bigger. The comparisons between Nixon and Watergate, I think this is much different and much more significant.
This is happening much more quickly.
Much more quickly.
So let me ask you this, because there are people on the right who would say this is nothing more than Democrats who are sore losers over an election rubbing their hands together because this is something that maybe could take him down.
Well, I think one thing we need to look at today, and this is absolutely the case, is how that divide between the Democrats and the Republicans are going to come down. We all know in political science, there is a saying that Congress members are single-minded seekers of reelection. And I'm curious to see if that's the only way this lens comes through today. Richard Burr, our senator from North Carolina, has been more circumspect. He said, let's get into this. I smell something.
Yeah. Prior to Richard Nixon, the word impeachment, I think, had last been uttered about a president in 1867 when Andrew Johnson, or 66 when Andrew Johnson was impeached. Now, since Nixon, we've had the impeachment of President Clinton. We've had rumors or desires to impeach almost every president since President Clinton at some point. Can we continue on like this?
Well, some people raised the question, was George H.W. Bush the last legitimate American president, right? Because people questioned the legitimacy of George W. Bush because of what happened in Florida. They questioned the legitimacy of Bill Clinton, going back to the controversies out of Arkansas. They questioned Obama's citizenship and his ability to serve. And coming in, people questioned Donald Trump, right? But this is something more than partisanship. To Dr. Campbell's point, there is an objective reality out there, independent of how we feel about it from a partisan or ideological perspective. You had 17 intelligence agencies coming to the conclusion that Russians attempted to interfere in the American election. This from the United States' former great transatlantic foe, right?
Well, this affects this affects both Republicans and Democrats. So why does it appear, and this is my through my lens now, why does it appear that Republicans appear less concerned?
Because people are looking at it as a partisan witch hunt. But one of the things that floors me is that if you had said during the Cold War era in this country that in 2016, the Russian government would attempt to influence the outcome of an American election, and thereafter people would just say, well, it's just sour grapes from Democrats because their candidate lost. Mm-hmm. And that there would be no stomach or will to conduct a thorough investigation, I think the people of that era would be absolutely mortified. I think the American public would be mortified. And so this isn't about party. Country is supposed to be greater than party. And this is about maintaining the legitimacy of American institutions and American political participation.
Let's talk a little bit about what's about to happen here this morning in about 30 minutes from now when the hearings begin. And if you're listening to us at night, I apologize. You already know. In James Comey's opening statement to Congress this morning, it is reported that he will say that during a dinner meeting alone with the president in the White House on January 27th, his instincts told him that, quote, the one-on-one setting and the pretense that this was our first discussion about my position meant the dinner was, at least in part, an effort to have me ask for my job and create some sort of patronage relationship. The president asked Comey if he wanted to keep his job, and then Comey will tell the committee that the president said, I need loyalty, I expect loyalty, I didn't move, he said, I didn't speak or change my facial expression in any way during the awkward silence that followed. This is all a quote from his opening statement. We simply looked at each other in silence. The conversation then moved on, but he returned to the subject near the end of our dinner. And this was 7 days, 7 days into the Trump presidency. Could this merely be an ill-advised choice of words from a non-politician businessman who didn't at that point in time really fully understand the machinations of government or the need for some sort of separation between the executive branch and law enforcement, and not some sort of veiled demand to stop an investigation?
Well, at the risk of offending some of your listeners, I don't think it was the response of someone that at that time didn't understand. It's someone that doesn't want to understand and clearly doesn't want to understand. It's a stubborn ignorance of what went on. If you look at some of the, in addition to all the things we've talked about, he has contempt for ethics. Jeff Sessions said, I'm going to recuse myself, and now Jeff Sessions is in the hot seat. I think he demands loyalty from everyone. I think we've talked about he's being in the hot seat about Jared Kushner, who is, you know, outside of government, but he's a son-in-law. I think that really he didn't understand it. He doesn't understand it, and he doesn't want to understand it. And he thinks, here's my plan, implement it. And that's not what Congress is all about. When it failed, his health care plan failed, it became Ryan's health care plan. He didn't want responsibility for that. So loyalty is how he's, you know, they say that if you're not loyal in this business, you were fired. Yeah. And I'm not just making a play on words about the reality TV show. I think he doesn't want to understand. I think he knows what's good for the country, and the country that voted for him, the people that voted for him said, it's good to have a business person in office. And that's how he's conducted himself, and not someone that understands, as we've all talked about, the Constitution and constitutional crises that could go on with this. It's, you know, it's very dramatic. Even if the testimony that we've seen, the opening remarks, because they're more muted, they're probably dead on, spot on. They're true.
But if you run as a businessman saying that business principles can save the country money, that we can organize the government in such a way that it's more efficient and less intrusive, and then you get to that position of power, as Mr. Trump has, and suddenly you try to act like this is your company and not the government— there's nothing illegal about that, is there? I mean, it could work if you – could it work? Let me ask that question. Could that work if you also stuck to ethics and legalities?
Well, first thing, if the thing with Trump and Comey happens once, you can blame it on inexperience or naivete. But according to Comey's pre-testimony, it happened twice that the president tried to get him in a room alone to ask him to back off the Russia investigation. So twice – raises questions. Now, as far as running government on a business model, George W. Bush was the first American president to have an MBA, and he brought some of that sensibility to his approach. And what that meant was putting people in positions within the government whose talents you believed in, and then giving them the wherewithal to do that job. It wasn't micromanaging. It was placing people in place and then letting them run, right? It was a different philosophical approach on how things ought to be done. This president, his approach seems to be much more heavy-handed when it comes to doing certain things.
James Comey had a meeting with other officials from the government with then-President-elect Trump in New York, in Trump Tower. And coming away from that meeting in the FBI car on the street in New York, he opened a laptop and documented that conversation immediately. And he has documented every conversation he's had with the president since then. He has said, James Comey has said, that he did not document his conversations with President Obama. Now, could that open up the viewpoint on the part of some people that this smacks of politics on the part of James Comey? He didn't document the Obama conversations, but he did the Trump conversations. Dr. Campbell.
You know, as a historian, I want to stress the importance of context. And you're absolutely right. I mean, you can take any little fact, like particularly that fact about Obama, and say, look what he did here. But we need to view all of these statements that are coming from the Trump White House and Comey's specific stories in the larger context of what's happened in the last few months. And when you kind of step away, and I think as we watch the hearings today, instead of getting pulled into the details, if you step back and look at the big context to try to understand these things, it gets worse instead of better for the president. I mean, whether this is a story of obstruction of justice, whether this is a story of a failed White House, and let's not forget what we've said on this program several times, we're talking about an administration, Trump maybe not, but the administration that worked with foreign enemies of the United States establishing back channels in what could be treasonous behavior. I mean, this is unprecedented in American political scandal. And so I think that the context of this is what is so important about what's going to be happening in the next few days.
And to expand upon what Dr. Campbell just said, Comey was a lifelong Republican until 2016. And his political contributions and things of that sort were to Republican candidates. He only became an independent in 2016. So if there's a partisan axe to grind here, that's not with him. If anything, people might say that this is a disgruntled former employee going after his boss. But what you have now is that you had the former acting attorney general be fired and then testify against the administration. And she's someone that had ties to Democratic candidates and things like that over her career. But as an attorney, said that I had to do my job. And I thought that it was in the national interest to advise the president in the way that I did. And now you have someone who's longtime Republican who's also going to testify in a manner that's critical of this administration. And so the legitimate criticisms are being made from people on different sides of the aisle who have been a part of the administration and were both dismissed because they were doing things that ultimately the president did not like them doing. And the president referred to the former FBI director as a crazy person and a nut job the day after he dismissed him.
To the Russians.
This sounds a little bit like the Saturday Night Massacre, and many comparisons have been made to what's happening now to what happened ultimately in the Watergate investigation. At this stage of the Watergate investigation, were we seriously talking about impeachment? Can you make these comparisons? Dr. Campbell, is this Watergate redux?
In many ways, yes. It really is. But Watergate took 2 years, and this would be most like John Dean's testimony. John Dean testified in the early summer of 1973 before another North Carolina senator, Sam Ervin, and he laid out step by step that the president knew, the president has lied, the president was aware, and it became just like this. We have, who are you going to believe? And that, it was so theatrical, and I keep this in mind today. John Dean wore contacts and sporty clothes, but for that day he wore big thick glasses and very conservative suits. It was all stage theater because he knew that the point was winning over the long-term American people's trust. John Dean had a role to play, and Sam Ervin, who was running those hearings, had a role to play in this theater.
I want to come back to that in a second. Sam Ervin, because he's a North Carolinian, as is Senator Richard Burr, who chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee, holding the hearings today. That's Dr. Carl Campbell from App State. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Wild Birds Unlimited Charlotte, bringing people and nature together with bird feeding and nature products. Located at Galleria off Independence and Huntersville Exit 25, online at charlotte.wbu.com. And UNC Charlotte's Cato College of Education's graduate certificate in teaching programs, offering both online and class formats in middle, secondary, and special education. Details and registration at pathwaytoteaching.com. Coverage of James Comey's testimony to the Senate Intelligence Committee continues next hour here on NPR and WFAE. The former FBI director answers questions about the Russia investigation and whether President Trump pressured him as part of that probe. And you can stay with NPR this afternoon for analysis of today's hearing. That all begins 20 minutes from right now. Stay with us. We're coming right back.
Next time on The World, protecting America's shores. Members of the U.S. Coast Guard have 95,000 miles of coastline to protect, and they have to be ready for anything.
We have mounted automatic weapons on our vessels. That deters a lot of threats, I believe.
We ride along with the Coast Guard and update all the news on the next edition of The World.
Today at 3 on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about what's happening this morning with the Comey hearings in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee on Capitol Hill. Dr. Adolphus Belk is with us, along with Dr. Susan Roberts, both in our studio. Dr. Belk is with Winthrop University, and Dr. Roberts is with Davidson College. They're both political science professors, and Dr. Carl Campbell is joining us by phone from Durham. He is an associate professor of history at Appalachian State University. Let's talk about some of the players here. This is Richard Burr's committee, Senator Richard Burr from North Carolina. Of course, the Watergate hearings were conducted by another North Carolinian, Senator Sam Ervin. The difference being Ervin was a Democrat investigating a Republican president. This is a Republican investigating a Republican president. What do you expect from Richard Burr, and what do you see as how he has conducted himself thus far? Because the House version of this committee has not been as stellar, shall we say.
I think Burr has a greater grasp on the significance of the work, and he's trying to play it down the middle. You know, we have a responsibility as an institution to hold the executive branch accountable, and this is something that warrants investigation. He seems to be more aware of how this is going to play, not just in this moment, mm-hmm. but across time and across space. And so if the committee's work is going to be regarded as legitimate, then there needs to be a certain approach to it all. And so he seems to be mindful of that. Now, Burr is a major player in terms of how the committee is going to go, as is Senator Mark Warner of Virginia. But there are others who are part of this as well. This investigation was supposed to be conducted by the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions had to recuse himself because he had said he had no contact with the Russians, and then it was later determined that he had two meetings. So then it goes to the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, who 1 week after Comey was fired was then replaced by a special counsel. That special counsel is former longtime FBI Director Robert Mueller, who's assembling what some people are calling an all-star team of prosecutors to investigate this, including people that were responsible for bringing down Nixon with Watergate, Enron, and different elements of the mafia in the United States. So there are some serious players at work here. I think Burr understands that, mm-hmm. and so he has to lead this a certain type of way.
And Dr. Campbell, you wrote a biography of North Carolina Senator Sam Ervin, who chaired the Watergate Committee. Another North Carolina senator, as we've said, Richard Burr chairs this committee, and you've said that you believe Senator Burr has the opportunity to rise to the occasion as Sam Ervin did. But there was far less partisanship back in the 1970s. Ervin was a Democrat, Nixon a Republican. Is this an opportunity to distinguish himself and be compared to Sam Ervin? Do you think that that opportunity has occurred to Senator Burr? Should it occur to him?
I'm not an expert on Senator Burr, but I am sure that this will be the defining moment of his historical legacy. Like Ervin was not well known before Watergate, and neither was Burr. They're both well respected. There is a difference in the party lineup. But I think that we've seen signs there was an original early mistake by Burr when he worked with the White House and was kind of saying things that seemed very partisan, but he's been backing off. His performance yesterday was very strong. Now, Ervin had the advantage of being a very strong personality. I'm just an old country lawyer, and I'm going to tell you stories from down home in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And that conservative southernness helped to convince people about the truth about Nixon. Burr doesn't have that kind of a strong personality. But if he positions himself as a fair player and a straight shooter who's honestly trying to get to the truth, I really think that this could be Burr's defining moment. And I think that he's being pulled between his partisan heart and his partisan pressure and his loyalty to bigger constitutional and patriotic questions. And I think that Burr could be one of the key players in how this all comes out. And may I just add, too, it's good to see that Warner and Burr seem to be cooperating together, much like Baker and Ervin did during Watergate.
Yesterday, Admiral Michael Rogers, the director of the National Security Agency, and Daniel Coats, the director of National Intelligence, each said they had never felt pressured to do anything inappropriate. And the key word there is felt. And they were talking about feelings versus facts, but they refused to confirm or deny allegations that Trump asked them to state publicly that they saw no evidence of Trump campaign collusion with Russia. Now, the Democrats are clearly upset by this, and pundits have said that there was no legal reason that the two could not respond. Dr. Roberts, what does this tell you?
Well, I think they also used the words, I agreed to testify, but not in a public venue, and those phrases, to the best of my recollection. And I think both of those point to the fact that, you know, are they going to ask for legal representation for themselves? I think it really gives us the idea that there is something there. I want to add one thing about Richard Burr, and this is tertiary. It's not primary. But Richard Burr is recently reelected. He has the freedom electorally to do what is right for the country. And I think that gives him the window of saying, I'm going to say some things that are unpopular with my party. I think Richard Burr, like Sam Ervin, people will learn to say, this is a voice of reason. People looked at Senator Sam as someone that they could get a constitutional cue to. What is constitutional? What does this mean? And I think Richard Burr is looking at the larger context of what is the rule of law and not men.
The fact that yesterday Mr. Rogers and Mr. Coates, Admiral Rogers and Mr. Coates, refused to make a distinction between, they said they were never directed to do anything. And the question from Marco Rubio was, were you asked to? And they would not answer that. They would say, I was never directed to. There's a difference. It's a small hair, but nonetheless a difference. Following the testimony, Richard Burr, the chairman, said he had one final message that he wanted witnesses to deliver to the Trump administration. He said that in cases where there's sensitivity of activities, there is a mechanism for congressional oversight whereby officials can brief and notify the Gang of Eight, which includes congressional leadership in both the House and Senate on both sides of the aisle. And he warned them, quote, at no time should you be in a position to come to Congress without an answer. And then the co-chair, Democratic Virginia Senator Mark Warner, said the president is not above the law. Is this normal rhetoric for procedures like this, Dr. Campbell?
It is not normal rhetoric in political manipulations and in regular hearings. But I think it is admirable rhetoric and appropriate for what we're seeing here. I mean, let's make no mistake. This isn't politics as usual. This is a moment of American history in which there's some big questions being asked. I mean, whether or not this form of government really can sustain itself going forward. The rule of law, the rule of Congress, the role of the press. And to see that yesterday, Warner and Burr working together gave me some hope that we will see a positive outcome in these hearings.
But what you just said to me sounds far more serious than Watergate. I mean, you're talking not just about a constitutional crisis, you're talking about an existential crisis. Am I hearing you correctly?
I think that Watergate was equally important. Watergate really brought to the very core the idea of the rule of law and presidential imperial power. And that was a different kind of question, but I think that was an existential threat. But what we're facing now does have an added element of a foreign body, you know, an enemy, the Russians. And we keep kind of, that story has been pushed aside because of this question about Donald Trump and whether he's, you know, stopping the investigation. And that's important. But I predict that as we go through these next few weeks and months, we're going to see various storylines, and these storylines are going to become increasingly significant. And I think the group to watch are the moderate, about four or five Republicans on that Senate committee, and watch the moderate Republican supporters of Trump and whether or not they begin to ask the bigger questions instead of just feeling defensive about their man.
Let me get the perspective of our two political scientists here, because what I heard there was an existential crisis, a national, will we continue to exist as a nation? Constitution aside, with the attacks on the press and on all of the institutions of government, is it that serious?
Well, I think it's that serious, because I think we have to look at ourselves, even in stepping back from this, on an international stage. Where are we as a world power? And it's not just a matter of, you know, I think you're right, it is existential, but it's also ideological and philosophical, and it's practical. It has practical consequences. If there is, and I just want to get this in, maybe it's a detour, if there is one good thing to come out of this testimony and these hearings, is we have introduced or reintroduced several concepts and things people are talking about. What is obstruction of justice? What is executive privilege? What is impeachment? And that may be the only good thing to come out of this, because as we've said, everything else is polarizing.
Mike Rogers is the director of the National Security Agency. He's the top Pentagon cyber officer. He was one of those people who concluded that the Russians interfered and did so in a way to hurt Secretary Clinton and to aid Mr. Trump. And it's reported that he was asked by Mr. Trump to stop the allegations of collusion. So when he sat there yesterday and didn't answer some of those questions, it sent Senator Angus King through the roof. Angus King is an independent from Maine. And he said, are you invoking executive privilege?
Yeah.
Because if you're not, you're supposed to answer the question. And if you are, that raises another issue. And so, yes, this is a big, big deal.
Why didn't they answer the question?
I think in some ways people want to be mindful of the things that they say that could possibly damage them from a criminal standpoint, because you're testifying under oath. And when you're testifying under oath, the things you say are admissible in a court of law. They didn't go so far as pleading the fifth, but they came kind of close to it. So they were in this sort of legal no man's land, no woman's land, where they said, it's not executive privilege. We're not invoking the Fifth Amendment, but we're not going to answer your question.
Why not? And, I mean, if they were asked, were you directed? That wasn't anything that they did. It was something they were asked to do.
And that's why Senator King went apocalyptic, and that's why Senators Burr and Warner are trying to reemphasize to those coming before the committee that they have an obligation to talk to the committee.
So overlaid over all of this is the politics of this, and clearly the Democrats see a political opportunity here in these investigations, but Republicans seem to be in a much trickier position, it seems to me. What do they have to do to survive this in case any of these investigations turn up wrongdoing by members of the campaign staff or ultimately by the president himself?
Well, I think that when you look at it in terms of political terms, the Republicans do have to think about, how do I want to associate myself with this president in the next election, or philosophically going forward as a conservative, a Republican, a representative of my district? I think that the Democrats should not take this as pure partisan fodder. And those are real risks that they have to take. People will be looking for that. We understand. How many times in my classes have I said polarization? We understand that now.
What if the president and his campaign staff are cleared? What if nothing happened? What if the president is correct that nothing happened, he never touched the Russians, etc.? What message does that send? What happens as a result of that?
He can be cleared of being involved in the ways that might be impeachable, but then there are still questions about what did he know and when did he know it, right? In terms of how the GOP survives this, I mean, they should be feeling pretty good about themselves given what they've been able to achieve over the last several years. They stole a United States Supreme Court seat by refusing to hold a hearing with someone who was nominated, and they didn't suffer any consequences for that when it came to the size and strength of their coalition with those elections. So given some of the things that have happened and the way that they've been able to run out the clock on certain issues, if this doesn't ignite with the public and capture the public's imagination and becomes a bigger issue with the American people, then they can just sort of let it die.
Dr. Campbell, I want to do a little navel-gazing here with you for a moment here, because we're in the media, and the media has often been maligned in this country by politicians over the years, and it certainly happened during the Watergate investigation. The Washington Post pressed on, and they were proved to be right about their investigations, in spite of Richard Nixon's contrary statements and the fact that his vice president at the time, his disgraced vice president, Spiro Agnew, referred to us and people who were against Nixon as nattering nabobs of negativism. They came out unscathed on the other side. So what kind of a line does the media have to walk here to make sure that we don't end up being what Donald Trump says we are?
I've been very disappointed in the media. Part of it, of course, is that some people listen to Rachel Maddow and some people listen to Fox News. We're a very segmented society, and the press is much more divided and partisan than it was during Watergate. But, you know, there's something really sad going on about the media coverage. It really is driven by numbers, and it is driven by grabbing a tweet and running after that shiny object and keeping it moving with a breathlessness. I wish very much that the media would turn its conversations to the larger questions, talk about policy instead of horse race, and ask the big questions about what's going on. I was watching CNN last night, and I was learning a lot about the details of what's happening. I didn't get to hear a lot of analysis of the big questions. So I'm worried that the media could play right into what Trump wants it to be, and that it could fail in its job to frame and explain to the public what all these little details are about. We're a long, long way from knowing what this scandal is going to be. This is just the beginning.
That's Dr. Carl Campbell, Associate Professor of History at Appalachian State University. Also with us in our Spirit Square studio, Dr. Susan Roberts, Professor of Political Science at Davidson College, and Dr. Adolphus Belk, Professor of Political Science at Winthrop University. I hope we didn't fall into what you just described, Dr. Campbell. Thank you all for the hour.